Okay, so let's do it. All right, so remember we're dividing Daniel into two parts, 1 and 3 through 6, the practical stories of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego being faithful to God despite whatever is being done to them. And then last week, the last part we started, the second section of Daniel for us, which is chapters 2 and 7 through 12, which are visions of the future, the two themes, God rules the nations, God's in control, and staying righteous despite what's being done. They're connected because if you believe that God rules the nations, that God is in control, that God ultimately could, if he wanted, intervene, then that will help you to essentially behave as God wants, which is to be faithful to him. All right, so we looked at chapter 2. The vision of Nebuchadnezzar from 603 BC. All right, and he saw this picture for the next 2,000 years of Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. He said Rome would be a divided kingdom, that one half would be strong, the other half would be weak, and in the time of those kings, a rock would come up that would break and smash all the other kingdoms. It would itself endure forever, and we know that that is the church. All right, so here's your Babylonian Empire, the Persian Empire, Persian Mede Empire, Alexander's Empire, and Rome. Okay, great. Now, Daniel 7. Let's crank. Got to cover 6 chapters. We're going to have to crank. Division of 4 beasts. Any questions? Before we dive into the text here.
Why is there 3 of them?
The fourth one will be on the next slide. The vision is of the fourth beast. This is a vision concerning Rome. Daniel 8, by the way, concerns this beast right here. The lion, or the panther, or whatever with 4 wings. But anyway, in the first year Belshazzar, king of Babylon, so the year is 553 B.C., Daniel's now been in captivity for 52 years. Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying in bed. He wrote down the substance of the dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were in the 4 winds of heaven, churning up the great seas, 4 great beasts." By the way, this is called apocalyptic language. And this is standard kind of thing. The winds and the seas. The seas represents the peoples and these kinds of things. 4 great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion. It had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a human being, and the mind of a human was given to it. All right, they're trying to say human instead of man, but it was man. It's why they do that, since it's Nebuchadnezzar. So here's the first beast. Now this, basically the... what's the word? Not motto. What do they call the bald eagle for America? We call that our
mascot.
Yeah, the mascot for Babylon was the lion. This is taken from the gate there, the gate in Babylon. And Babylon is described as an eagle in Jeremiah 48:40. Look, an eagle is swooping down. So the eagle imagery and the lion imagery both clearly are references to Babylon. And it says, he stood up and was given the heart of a man. That's talking about Nebuchadnezzar, who essentially, his heart was changed by God, and he came to actually believe in God. Of course, this is not much of a prophecy, because in 553 BC, this had already happened. Okay, let's read about the next beast. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on its sides. It had 3 ribs in its mouth. Between its teeth, it was told, "Get up and eat your fill of flesh." So this reminds me of the Flintstones. All right. And so the 3 ribs are Lydia, Babylon, and Egypt. How do I know that? Well, because the second beast is the Persian Mede Empire, begun by Cyrus the Great. And every single detail, every slightest detail in every single one of these visions has a definite, I would say, unmistakable historical fulfillment. And it just so happens that Cyrus and his son Cambyses conquered 3 great empires, not 4, not 2, 3. And so that would be Lydia, Babylon and Egypt. Okay, this vision is not focusing in on the lion or on the bear, so let's keep going. After that, I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard. That's not a very convincing leopard, is it? But anyway. And on its back, it had four wings like those of a bird. The beast had four heads. It was given authority to rule. Now, these four wings, these four heads represent four empires that emerged from Alexander the Great. I'm not going to cover that yet because that's in Daniel chapter 8. After that, my vision, and I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, a terrifying, here you go, there's the fourth beast, okay? A terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth, iron. Iron, what's that remind you of? Daniel 2? Rome, got it? It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victim. It trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. Well, I was thinking about the horns. There before me was another horn, a little one, which came among them, and three of the first horns were uprooted before it. This horn had eyes like the eyes of a human being and the mouth that spoke boastfully. All right. Then I continue, verse 11, to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain, its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but were allowed to live for a period of time. All right, now imagine you're Daniel and you see this vision and you're saying to yourself, I have to actually write this down, you know, the beast with 10 horns and a little horn say, ha, 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 I'm better than you. And he knocks down three other horns. I mean, how bizarre is that? But I'm telling you, I can tell you the name of the first horn, the second horn, the third. I can tell you exactly their name. I can tell you when they ruled. I can tell you who the little horn is. I can tell you the three knocked down are because this is a matter of history. Okay, now let's do this. I'm going to skip down because Daniel's given an interpretation. He's given an interpretation of the dream. All right. Let's go to that of verse 20. I'll start in verse 19. Then I wanted to know the meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, and most terrifying, with its iron teeth and bronze claws. The beast that crushed and devoured its victims, trampled underfoot whatever was left. I also want to know about the 10 horns on its head and about the other horn, which came up before which three of them fell, the horn that looked more imposing than the others, even though it was smaller, which is interesting, that had eyes and a mouth that spoke boastfully. As I watched, this horn was waging war against the holy people and defeating them. Ah, here's a hint about who he is. He's fighting against the saints and defeating them. Until the Ancient of Days came and pronounced judgment in favor of the holy people of the Most High, and the time came when they possessed the kingdom. He gave me this explanation. The fourth beast is a fourth kingdom. By the way, remember, people want to say that the book of Daniel was written after the events prophesied. Those will be the events prophesied not in Daniel 7, but in Daniel 8, concerning Antiochus Epiphanes. But this prophecy involves things that happened in the 90s AD. So how are they going to explain that away? Well, what they say is this fourth beast is actually Greece. So they'll say the first king is Nebuchadnezzar. The second king represents his kingdom. The third king is Persia Media. And the fourth is Greece, which makes absolutely no sense. It makes no sense whatsoever. Besides, he even says, essentially, that this iron one is the same as in the former one. The reason they say that is because anything else means Daniel's inspired by God. And these people have decided that can't be the case. So they absolutely refuse to even admit the possibility of any interpretation that defeats their own worldview, which happens to be a wrong worldview. And it's so obvious that this is about Rome, it's kind of ridiculous. Therefore, these people themselves are kind of ridiculous, if you ask me. All right, the fourth beast is a fourth kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar was not a kingdom. All right, Babylon was a kingdom. But anyway, that's what they do. It will be different from all the other kingdoms and will devour the whole earth, trampling it down and crushing it. The 10 horns are 10 kings. All right, who will come from this kingdom. After them, another king will arise, different from the earlier ones. He will subdue three kings. He will speak against the Most High and oppress his holy people and try to change the set times and laws. The holy people were delivered into his hands for a time, times, and half a time. All right. Now, was Rome a kingdom? No, it was not. It was a republic. For over 700 years, Rome was a republic. At the time Daniel wrote, Rome was a tiny principality on the Tiber River. The Etruscans were the main power in Italy. All right, but it turns out about 600 years after the time of Daniel, Rome started to have kings. And here is the list. Julius Caesar tried to claim to be emperor, but he was rejected and killed. The first proclaimed emperor of Rome was Augustus. Augustus, Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero, Galba, blah, blah, blah. Number 11. The 11th, this is the little horn. This is the one who attacked the saints. The first Roman emperor to systematically attack the church was Domitian. He made Christianity illegal. Now, when you go to Revelation 17, he'll call Domitian the 8th instead of the 11th. And he says that Domitian is sort of like a resurrection of Nero. Nero had a bad day and killed a few Christians. He never persecuted the church generally. All right, now, what are those three? You know those three that he knocked down? Those three are Galba, Otho, and Vitellius. Now, what happened is Nero died in 68 AD. At that time, Vespasian was surrounding Jerusalem during the Jewish wars, as prophesied by Daniel in Daniel chapter 9. That's sort of cool. Anyway, he was the obvious person because Nero was the end of the Julian-Claudian line. In other words, he had no male heirs. So at that point, chaos broke out in Rome. Temporarily, Galba, Otho, and Vitellius, in different parts of the empire, were declared emperor. And look how long they ruled. For, 6 months, 3 months, 8 months. You can read about it in Suetonius' book. All the details are there. So what happened was Vespasian, who was the obvious person to take power, was, 2,000 miles away in Jerusalem. So he headed back to Rome. And while he was on his way, he left Titus behind. Titus, the next year, defeated Jerusalem, destroyed it, and all that sort of stuff. Again, fulfilling the prophecy in Daniel 9. But in the meantime, his younger son, Domitian, was in Rome, helping to defeat Galba, Otho, and Vitellius. Now, how many times in history has one ruler overcome three former rulers in the line that would lead to him? How often does that happen? Like, never. So the question is, how did Daniel know 650, almost 700 years beforehand, that the 11th emperor of Rome would persecute the saints? And that he would be involved in somehow removing three prior rulers? But that's not all. What does it say about this guy Domitian? He says, he will speak against the Most High and suppress his holy people. Now, earlier it called him boastful. Domitian was so boastful, here he is, that statue's in the museum in Rome, and that it's like this high, just the head alone is this guy. This guy was a prideful dude, to say the least. All right, he was so prideful that his name was a byword for arrogance. They would say, that guy's a Domitian. All right. In other words, an arrogant jerk. In fact, he demanded to be addressed as my Lord God Domitian, the first Roman ruler to demand to be addressed as a god. All right. Now, it says here in Daniel 9, all right, he will subdue three kings, he'll speak against the Most High and oppress his holy people. He will try to change the set times and laws. Now, here's what Domitian did. All right, I thought I had a slide in this, but I don't. So what he did was he changed October into Domitianus and November into Germanicus. And that was his surname. So the bottom line is, it'd be like Trump saying from now on, instead of July, it's Trump. I mean, seriously. Now, even Trump, as arrogant as he is, even he wouldn't have the nerve to do that. I mean, seriously. But that's what he did. Now, did anybody ever name a month after an emperor? Sure, Augustus. But Augustus didn't do that. He was long dead. Oh, and July, Julius Caesar. Okay, got it. In fact, do you ever notice that October is the 10th month? Octopus. The reason October is the 10th month is because they added July and August after, you know, right, November, all that sort of stuff. But this guy, he tried to change the set times. Now, how did Daniel know this 700 years before? What was happening here in the San Joaquin Valley 700 years ago? Just to give you a few, I mean, had Columbus sailed the ocean blue yet? No, he had not. I mean, that's how long a time we're talking about. This is not 5 years, 700 years almost. That's amazing. It also said he tried to change the set times and the laws. Now, the most famous legal system in all history was the Roman legal system. Justinian updated it. It's the legal system in France and South America and Mexico and all these places. This arrogant jerk, Domitian, he canceled all the Roman law and he created the Domitian law. This is a fact of history. You can read about it in Suetonius. All right, the day he died, they changed back to the Roman law. They changed October back to October, November back to November. But that, to me, to deny that this specific prophecy is indeed a prophecy involves sticking your head in the sand 10 times over. I mean, this is ridiculous. All right, so remember, go back to that beast with the 10 horns, little horn, knocking down 3 horns, all kind of stuff. This is exactly what happened. But what's the point? Stop right there. What's the point? So we can be so impressed of how amazing the Bible is? No. What's the point? Theme of Daniel. God rules the nations. That's the point. Not, isn't that so awesome that God could do this prophecy? The point is, God is in control. And again, the lesson of Daniel, the question for you is, do you believe that? Do you really believe? That doesn't mean that he's in control and as in everything that happens is always because of him. I mean, there's forces of evil in the world. And God allows things to happen that aren't according to his will. But bottom line is, he could and he will if he so chooses. And the question is, do you believe that or not? All right. And I would say, under these circumstances, it's quite reasonable and rational to believe that, in fact, God does rule the nations. All right, so anyway, he will speak against the Most High, suppress the holy people, try to change the set times and laws. The holy people are delivered into his hands for a time, times, and half a time. That's 3.5 times. In apocalyptic language, does anybody know what the number 3.5 means? It's half of 7. All right, if you take our class on Revelation, maybe we'll do the class on Revelation eventually, that means a limited period of time. 7 is complete or perfect. 3.5 means partial. So in other words, the prophecy is that this persecution would continue for a limited period of time whose length is not being told. All right. In fact, this persecution lasted for about 200 years. The persecution of Rome. He declared Christianity illegal. It was not changed until 312 AD, which is 220 years later, roughly. Okay, got it? Now let's read on. But the court will sit. This is the heavenly court. You don't want to appear in that heavenly court if you're in trouble with God. It's a really bad place to be. And his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever. And the sovereignty and power and greatness of all the kingdoms of heaven will hand it over to the holy people of the Most High. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all rulers will worship and obey him. Amen for that? Awesome. All right. So I'm beginning to think that when Daniel says it's going to happen, it will indeed happen. Daniel 8. Now, I would say Daniel 8 is a little bit more crucial, maybe not to proving that the Bible is inspired by God, but to kind of the theme and the audience, because this involves Antiochus Epiphanes. Also, let's imagine that you're a Christian and you're being told that you need to offer sacrifice to the Roman gods and all that kind of stuff. Let's say it's the year 97 AD. And you're reading Daniel. Do you think the average Christian could count to 11? Do you think they could read Daniel 7 and possibly figure out the meaning of this prophecy? I think it's, of course they could. I mean, could they figure out which do you think they were aware of Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome? Of course they were. And, the point is, they could understand Daniel and go, all right, this is about us, time, times, and half a time. Besides, the ruler is going to sit, the persecutor is going to be judged, and we're going to reign forever. All right, so I'm thinking that this vision was an incredible encouragement to the early church. And if you didn't get this when you read Daniel 7, I tell you, they did. How could they not have gotten it? They knew exactly what Domitian did. They knew who the three little horses. How could they not know that? Everybody knew that. So this was common knowledge. All right, Daniel 8. A ram and a goat. In the third year of King Belshazzar's reign, so now we've gone from 555 BC to 551 BC. It's 2 years later. Belshazzar, I, Daniel, had a vision about the one that had already appeared to me. After the one that already appeared to me. In my vision, I saw myself in the citadel of Susa. So this is Susa. The citadel would be up on this hill. He's looking over the Ulai Canal. And Susa was in the capital of Elam, which was one of the three capitals of the Persian Mede Empire. And if he's looking across the Ulai Canal, he's looking to the west. So imagine he's in what would be western Iran today, and he's looking to the west towards Greece, essentially. Okay, I looked up, and there before me was a ram with two horns standing beside the canal. And the horns were long. One of the horns was longer, and the other one but grew up later. I watched the ram as it charged towards the west, the north, and the south. No animal could stand up against it. None could rescue from its power. It did as it pleased, and it became great. This is the Persian Mede Empire. Remember the three ribs in the mouth? That's north. Let me see. North, west, and south. All right. And turns out from Persia, Lydia is to the north. Babylon is to the west. And Egypt is to the south. So now we know not only three empires conquered by Cyrus, but we even have the correct geographic location to the north, to the west, and to the south. But this vision is not about Persian Mede. By the way, he talks about the two horns. The two horns are the Persian and Mede kings. And it turns out it was before Cyrus, it was Media, Persia. And after Cyrus, it was Persia, Media. Got it? So the one that grew up later, that would be Persia or Cyrus. Because when he took power, Persia became the dominant ruler in the dual empire rather than Media. All of this is not an amazing, spectacular prophecy because Cyrus actually conquered Lydia in like 551 BC. I mean, this Cyrus was alive when this prophecy was given. So this is not an amazing prophecy. It's true. Anyway, reading on. As I was thinking about this, suddenly a goat with a prominent horn between his eyes came from the west, crossing the whole earth without touching the ground. It came towards the two-horned ram I had seen standing beside the canal. It charged at it in a great rage. I saw it attack the ram furiously, striking the ram, shattering its two horns. The ram was powerless to stand against it. The goat knocked it to the ground, trampled on it. None could rescue the ram from its power. The goat became very great, but at the height of its power, the large horn was broken off, and in its place, four prominent horns grew up towards the four winds of heaven. These four prominent horns are the four heads and the four wings of Daniel 7. This is a beautiful description of the career of Alexander the Great. Now, this is 200 years after Daniel died. All right, so this is a prophecy of the future. He says he came from the west, and he charged towards the two-horned ram. And that's exactly, so the year is 335 BC. Alexander is 20 years old. He has an army of 30,000 troops, whereas Persia had a standing army of 200,000 troops. After crossing the Straits of Dardanelles into what we call Turkey, into Asia, literally burned his boats, and 2 years later he'd conquered the entire Persian Empire. The way it's described there is like floating over the ground and completely destroyed. Completely destroyed. The entire Persian Empire. Remember the map here. All right, so here's the Persian Empire. And how much was left when Alexander was done? None. The entire thing. There's an interesting story. Josephus tells us that when Alexander came to Jerusalem, the priest showed him a copy of the book of Daniel. And they said, they showed him Daniel 8. And they said, that's you. And the Greek empires always treated the Jews well until, you know who, Antiochus Epiphanes. So basically, he didn't do anything to Jerusalem, didn't harm it at all. That's fascinating to me. All right, so what it says is that the height of his power, okay, the year was 323 BC. He was only 35 years old. After conquering the greatest kingdom in the world up to that time, he died at the age of 35. It says the large horn was broken off, right? And he was married to Roxana, a Bactrian princess. She would be from Afghanistan from our perspective. She was pregnant. He had no children, no heirs. So what happened was his generals kind of fought it out over the next 3 years or so. And guess how many dynasties emerged from Alexander's kingdom? Just read the history. Remember, the book of Daniel is a book in a genre for which there's literally just one book in that genre, right? History of the future. How many?
Four.
And here they are. Antigonus, Cassander, Lysimachus, and Ptolemy. The most powerful of them was Antigonus, who took the east from Syria all the way to India. If you go back to that map, that was like half the entire empire was ruled by Antigonus. The other important character for us is Ptolemy, because Ptolemy and his successors will be the kings of the south. Okay, exactly what happened. Pretty awesome. But it gets better than that, or worse, depending on how you think about it. Let's read on. Out of one of them, just the next one, verse 11?
Nine,
okay, good. Out of one of them will come another horn, which started small but grew in power to the south, and to the east, and toward the beautiful land. It grew until it reached the host of heavens. It threw down some of the starry hosts. This is apocalyptic language. What that means is it's describing the day of the Lord. It's describing judgment coming either on God's people or on his enemies. This kind of language always is in reference to God coming, the day of the Lord. It's called in the Old Testament. All right, got it? And who's going to be judged? The answer is God's people, in this case, are being judged. Anyway, set itself up to be, until it reached the host of the heavens, it threw some of the star hosts down to the earth and it trampled on them. It set itself up to be as great as the commander of the army of the Lord. It took away the daily sacrifice of the Lord and his sanctuary was thrown down. Because of rebellion, the Lord's people and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did and truth was thrown to the ground. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, the one who came, who grew small, who came from one of them and grew small, and then to the south and to the east in the beautiful land, his name was Seleucus. There he is, Seleucus I Nicator. He's kind of a good-looking guy, if you trust the statue. But anyway, he was a general of Ptolemy. And he attacked Antigonus, and he conquered Syria. Okay? Now, he said to himself, hey, what am I, sliced bread? He said, I'm going to have my own dynasty. So a fifth dynasty emerged about 8 years after the other four. Anyway, so then he took Mesopotamia to the south, and then he took Persia to the east, and then he took the beautiful land. What land? Beulah land. What's the beautiful land? What's he talking about? Talking about Canaan, right? Actually, it was his great-grandson, or maybe it was his great-great-grandson. But finally, Antiochus I the Great took Palestine and the Jews from Ptolemy. So there's going to be a warfare between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. That's going to be described in great detail in Daniel 11. Okay, so what did this guy do? He's going to start talking now about Antiochus Epiphanes. What did Antiochus Epiphanes do? Well, let's see. He took away, verse 11, it set itself up to be as great as the commander of the army of the Lord. It took away daily sacrifice in the Lord. His sanctuary was thrown down because of rebellion. The Lord's people and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually read in the first book of 1 Maccabees about this. Okay? 1 Maccabees chapter 1, verse 41 through 54. So this is a historical account. This is history. This is normal history. It's not history of the future. This is history of the past. 1 Maccabees was written after this happened. All right, let me see. Then the king issued a proclamation to his whole kingdom that all were to become a single people. This is Antiochus. Each renouncing his particular customs, all the pagans conformed to the king's decree, and many Israelites chose to accept the religion, sacrificing to idols and profaning the Sabbath. The king also sent instructions by messenger to Jerusalem, the towns of Judah, directing them to adopt customs foreign to the country, banning holocausts, in other words, sacrifices, and libations from the sanctuary, profaning Sabbaths and feasts, defiling the sanctuary and the sacred ministers, building altars, precincts, and shrines for idols, sacrificing pigs and unclean beasts, leaving their sons uncircumcised and prostituting themselves to all kinds of impurity and abomination, so that they should forget the law and revoke all observance of it. Anyone not obeying the king's command was to be put to death. Writing in such terms to every part of his kingdom, the king appointed inspectors for the whole people and directed all the towns of Judah to offer sacrifice one after another. And it turns out, as it prophesies here, many of the Jews said, sure, we'll just go ahead and do that. And that's what happened. Now, why did this happen? Why did God allow this terrible devastation of the Jewish people to happen according to the prophecy? It says why. Because of rebellion. Because of the Jews' rebellion. The Jews were unfaithful. And God allowed them to be judged. And what does the Bible say? It says judgment begins with who? With the house of the Lord. With God's house. And what's interesting... By the way, I'm going to stop in about 5 minutes. It's break time. But so, do you think that when this happened, the average Jew was thinking, thank you so much, God, for coming in judgment on us? No. Do you think they were feeling like God was in control? Probably not. But wait a minute. What prophecy could they have read? Daniel. And do you think that they knew enough history that they could kind of figure out, okay, the prominent horn, you know, the two horns and the prominent horn and the four kings and the fifth one. And probably if they knew a little bit of history, they could figure out what's going on. They realized, oh, God prophesied this. By the way, during this time, the period is 167 to 164 BC. This is when the Hasidim took control in Jerusalem. This is the time of the greatest flowering of Jewish culture, political power, and really Jewish religion from the time of David all the way down to the time of Jesus. In other words, the direct result of this horrible persecution was that Judaism flourished. The Hasidim, the righteous ones, eventually became the Pharisees. And by the way, they're the good guys. In the New Testament, amongst the Jews, the Pharisees are actually the good guys because they're the ones who are holding on to righteousness, holding on to the Bible, and they held on to some other stuff they shouldn't have. So the result of this terrible, terrible persecution, which God either allowed or probably even caused, it looks like caused, the purpose of it was to purify God's people. If we become arrogant and disobedient, God will allow us to suffer the consequences. Anybody been in our movement for over 20 years? All right. Do you know what I'm talking about? All right. If you haven't been, well, just trust me. God doesn't put up with arrogance. He will step in because of rebellion. Why did this happen? Because the Jews had not been faithful. And they were purified. During this terrible situation, many Jews, in fact, most Jews said, it's cool. You know, you can read about it. Read about it in 1 Maccabees. But as a result of that, they're purified. And within just a few years, the heart of the Jews was turned almost completely 180 in an opposite direction because God stepped in. He caused it to happen. All right? It says in verse 24, he'd become very strong, but not by his own power. Let's skip down there because we have an interpretation here. 24 and 25. We have the interpretation. In the latter part of verse 23, in the latter part of their reign, that's of the Greek emperor's reigns, when rebels have become completely wicked, a fierce-looking king, a master of intrigue, that's Antiochus Epiphanes, that guy right there. All right? Will arise. He'll become very strong, but not by his own power, right? By God's power. Just like Cyrus. Just like Nebuchadnezzar. Just like your boss. Or the person who's persecuting you. The person who you don't appreciate what they're doing in your life right now. He will cause astounding devastation, will succeed in whatever he does. He will destroy those who are mighty, the holy people. He will cause deceit to prosper. He will consider himself superior. When they feel secure, he will destroy many and take his stand against the prince of princes. Yet he will be destroyed again, but not by human power. By the way, it says here, going back to the early verse, it says here, he'll set himself up to be as great as the commander of the army of the Lord, verse 11. What he did was he had pigs sacrificed in the Holy of Holies and the blood of pigs smeared all over the place. Then he put a statue right above where the Holy of Holies was, and the face on the statue was the face of Antiochus Epiphanes. And he literally set himself up to be as great as the army of the Lord's host or whatever. He literally did that. Exactly as prophesied. By the way, this is the abomination of desolation. This is the abomination of desolation, which was repeated again in 70 AD. We'll talk about that after we take our break. Let me finish out this vision here. This is the awesome part. We haven't even gotten to the awesome part yet. Then I heard a holy one speaking, verse 13. Another one, holy one, said to him, how long will it take for the vision to be fulfilled? The vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that causes desolation, the surrender of the sanctuary, and the trampling underfoot of the Lord's people. He said to me, it will take 2,300 evenings and mornings. Then the sanctuary will be reconsecrated. Okay? So we don't know the exact date of the initial desolation of the temple. The best estimate is sometime in November, 167 BC. We know the exact date of the rededication of the temple. It's right there. We'll read it in 1 Maccabees. And it's the 25th of December, 164 BC. Now, he said 2,300 evenings and mornings, which is 1,150 days. The actual length of this desolation of the temple was roughly 3 years, 1.5 months. You do the math, 1,150 days, plus or minus around 10 days, because we don't know the exact date. So that's pretty awesome. So you're one of the faithful, you're one of the Hasidim, one of the Maccabees, one of the ones who refuse to compromise, who are living in caves, and your children are being killed. You're circumcising your male children despite the threat of death. It's been 1,100 days, and you're thinking, well, I got 50 more days. Okay, because you know what? God rules the nations, and what he says is going to happen, that's exactly what's going to happen. So is that impressive or what? All right. Anyway, I'm going to skip the whole interpretation of the vision. I'm more or less given enough interpretation of the vision. Read my book on Daniel, and we're going to take our break. Good. Oh, and it went 40 minutes. Good.
Isn't it supposed to be 45?
Yeah, I thought I'd gone 45.